Let's continue with our assessment of C.K. Blandin's later years, and that subject is going to lead us directly to the high point in the history of the Blandin Paper Company. In the mid-1950s, there was no topic more discussed in paper-making circles and written about in the paper trade publications than the developments that were taking place in the little mill in Grand Rapids. So let's get a little bit of background here and see what's going on and what is happening. In a 1951 issue of the Broke Pile, Blandin outlined the remarkable career of Edward Backus, founder of the giant Minnesota and Ontario Paper Company. Blandin believed that the key to understanding Backus' downfall, as we've noted, he never had recovered control of his company after it passed into receivership during the Depression, was his unrestrained ambition. Blandin thought of Backus as a one-man show who too frequently changed his executive staff and failed to inspire loyalty among his employees. Blandin believed that Backus did not realize that it required many good actors as well as the headliners as represented in himself to operate a large company. Blandin believed that he himself had avoided that pitfall. Well, Blandin was perhaps not entirely perceptive in his self-assessment, as many regarded him as egocentric and not always appreciative of services rendered. Nevertheless, as expressed by one of his associates, Blandin had the unusual ability of surrounding himself with very, very good people. Of all those good people, none contributed more in longevity, loyalty, hard work, or contributions to Blandin's success than mill manager C.K. Kirk Andrews. We've referred to him on and off in previous years, but let's take a better look at him. He's the one who is going to replace Bossert, so he goes way back into the early years of Blandin's gaining control of the company. Andrews supervised the day-to-day operation of the plant, bearing responsibility both for helping formulate and carrying out Blandin's policies for the paper company. His major strength lie not in any particular understanding of the technical or mechanical aspects of papermaking, but in his organizational skills and extreme devotion to duty. He was a thorough and careful planner, and he maintained tight, cohesive control of company personnel. Andrews was prone to stride across the dam from his home, which was near Blandin's villa, at any time during the night to inspect the work of the late shift. By 7 o'clock a.m. of a new day, he knew exactly the state of the mill, and through the next shifts he was relentless in checking in all departments. He carried a notebook to keep track of his observations, and he did not fail to make certain that his orders were carried out and his inquiries satisfactorily answered. One of Andrew's secretaries remembered resigning herself to his habit of starting dictation at 5 o'clock p.m. when everyone else was headed for home. His secretarial staff felt some small relief when Andrews discovered golf and allowed himself the indulgence of disappearing on occasional summer Saturday afternoons. Those who worked for Andrews held him in respect and found him fair, if extremely demanding. He was not prone to accept explanations when matters were not going well, and from both himself and others he demanded results, not excuses, as proclaimed by the sign on his office wall. Longtime employee Alva Sieber remembered, he was always looking over your shoulder while you were trying to fix something he didn't really understand. He was kind of a pest, but he was very sincere about it. Andrews was well known in the mill for his quick temper, and he carried on the Bossert tradition of turning the air blue when exasperated with mechanical or employee failure. Company secretary remembered years later, Mr. Blandin and Mr. Andrews were two entirely different people. Mr. Andrews always made a tour through the mill before he would come into the office in the morning, and he made a good check on everything. If things weren't just right, he'd walk in the office, slam the door behind him, and yell at me, get me so-and-so on the phone. I would get him so-and-so, and he would give him the dickens, and then hang up the phone so it would fall off the hook. He would be just furious, but he'd get over it very quickly. Now, Mr. Blandin, on the other hand, would take a while to get his temper up, and it would take him a while to forget, Mr. Andrews would forget right away and go back to his normal routine. He never, ever held a grudge. Mr. Papermill, as Andrew was dubbed by a colleague, played a leading role in maintaining smooth company operation. Yet, despite Andrew's strong personality and his ability to provide leadership in the mill, for Blandin, he was another of the employees to be used, sometimes unfeelingly, to accomplish his own ends. A fellow executive described Andrews as an overworked man whose whole life was serving Mr. Blandin. When he said jump, Andrews jumped. Another stated he was not really treated the way a mill manager should be because he was under the thumb of Blandin all the time. Andrews' salary was not generous, and on his extensive travels for the company, he was frugal, using every means to keep expenses low while he did not complain. His wife once confided to a friend that she didn't know how he stood the pressure of serving the unrelenting Charles Blandin. Whatever satisfaction Andrews found in his sometimes unrewarding but certainly challenging position, the comment of a company officer that he was the most loyal, best employee that Mr. Blandin ever had, bar none, describes him well. In 1950, Blandin reviewed the state of the paper company. Although a seller's market had been of great advantage to the Grand Rapids Mill during post-war years, Blandin, thinking both of past experience and of the dam breaks, was somber. He wondered how long the seller's market would prevail and stated that the customer, as he said, the lamb that was pleading for favors from the manufacturer, was now reverting to the wolfish creature with the old-time snap and growl. He was aware that increased groundwood paper production in the United States was leading to increased competition. Blandin mused that in a highly competitive market, an integrated mill, that is one that controlled all aspects of production, including the manufacture of chemical pulp, would have a decided advantage. Yet construction of a facility for producing chemical pulp in Grand Rapids would be impractical. The mill was not big enough to warrant the estimated $1.5 million expense or to use enough chemical pulp to make such an institution feasible. To increase production to better compete with the larger paper mills would involve more expenditure than could be afforded in the years of recovery from the dam breaks. Blandin estimated that the installation of a new Fourdrinier comparable to the number 3 machine would cost about $4 million. But despite the drawbacks of being a small and non-integrated mill, he strongly concluded, the Blandin Paper Company will be able to give a satisfactory account of itself in the future. And Blandin was correct in that. In the early 1950s, the Bulky Dunton Company, I haven't mentioned them before, but they had been hired by Blandin to serve as the sales force for the paper mill. So they found the customers and they handled the sales and all aspects that were concerned with that. And this company was finding customers for the mill by emphasizing that what they had to offer was bleached pulp, high grade, primarily super calendared roundwood papers. Daily production averaged 161 tons in 1952, and with a selling price of $165 per ton, net profits were a far cry from those bleak years of the 1930s. Labor relations were harmonious, and the base rate of pay was $1.33 an hour. Said Andrews, we continue to have, as we have for years, excellent cooperation from our employees. He realized that most buyers were becoming more quality-minded, and he emphasized again the need for producing the best paper possible. To that end, $1.5 million was spent in 1952 to improve and modernize the mill. The largest expenditure was for again rebuilding and refurbishing the venerable number 1 machine. For some perspective here, of the 16 states leading in paper manufacturing in 1952, Minnesota ranked last with just over one-third of the production of third place Wisconsin. Although the Blandin Paper Company manufactured only 52,000 tons, of the 556,000 tons of paper made in Minnesota, its emphasis on quality production provided customers of note. such prominent publications as Look, Boy's Life, Women's Day, True Confessions, Argosy, Newsweek, Better Homes and Gardens, and Coronet use Blandin paper. Edmund Whalen, editor of the Baroque Pile, among other duties, was asked to visit places using Blandin paper, and he found the experience humbling. At the Western Printing and Lithographing Company in Racine, Wisconsin, he was highly impressed with a huge plant covering 12 city blocks. The company was the largest publisher in the world of children's books. Whalen walked through the giant Western Printing warehouse looking at tier upon tier of rolls of paper purchased from many different companies. He observed, "It is there that you begin to realize how much competition there is in the paper business." Whalen noted that when a shipment of paper was received, every carload was carefully checked for loading procedures and wrapping. Written reports listed any problems caused by mill shipping department carelessness. Whalen continued his inspection, looking at the miles of automatic stitching and stapling and binding machines. He concluded, "If all of our employees at Blandin's could visit a plant such as Western's and see our paper being used in competition with dozens of other mills' paper, we would come back determined to do our utmost to make the quality of our paper such that the demand for it would be ever on the increase." The Elko Gravier printing plant in Chicago printed sections of Look magazine on Blandin Look Tone paper. The publishers of Look published the paper, which had to satisfy them as well as the printers. The Look publishers wanted paper free from glare, with a uniformly smooth surface and a proper degree of opacity. Those factors were also important to the printer, as were the proper degree of absorbency to hold and not smear the ink, and the strength to withstand considerable pull during the printing process. Whalen noted that a break on the printing press meant downtime of about an hour and the waste of about 300 pounds of paper. Again, he stressed the need for care and quality production in Grand Rapids. Rolls that are baggy, full of wrinkles and soft spots, will not stand the strain of going through the presses and consequently cause breaks. Doesn't take many such breaks to have the printer refuse to use the paper. Even one roll causing trouble in a shipment will sometimes cause the entire shipment to be rejected. In other words, all of our paper has to be the best in order to please our customers, and that is what every one of us should continually work for. It can't just get by and stay in demand. The Hall Printing Company, also in Chicago, printed such publications as True Confessions and Coronet, as well as Montgomery Ward and Sears catalogs. The story there was the same. Blandin orders made up only a minuscule portion of the paper used by the firm that in 1950 printed 480 million magazines, 225 million catalogs, and 132 million pocketbooks. Downtime in the presses due to poor paper was exorbitantly expensive, and Whalen again emphasized, "We cannot be too careful in turning out rolls of paper that are perfect." Whalen's analysis was sobering. Coupled with Blandin's thoughts about the lack of an integrated mill operation, it put into clear perspective the reality that the Blandin Paper Company, so big and important in Grand Rapids, was insignificant in comparison with some of the huge customers it supplied. The emphasis that Blandin and Andrews placed on continuing quality production and service may be easily understood. In the early 1950s, however, the Blandin Paper Company had to do more than maintain past success. And let's see what they are going to do and have to do when we start next time.